Okay, and in studio, as I said, we have Paddy Duffy, and he's an author and broadcaster. Again, good afternoon, Paddy.
Afternoon, no.
Now, we talked a while ago about some of your books. Now, the one that you have had first, tell us about your first novel and how it came about.
So, yeah, it was a... looking back on it, it's a bizarre story, really, because I had done a bit of... I had done a bit of work for RTE. They had asked me to do like a 3-minute radio column every Friday on drive time. And one of the weeks I remember I was on the road actually because I was working, and I had no idea what I was gonna write. I hadn't written the, you know, very close up to the deadline, and I was in Birmingham, and I got up very early that morning, and I was watching the BBC Breakfast News. And who's on the news? On BBC News. But Jackie Healy-Raye's son, Danny.
Yeah.
And I'm going, what is going on here? Am I hallucinating? Like, am I having some sort of bad dream? And then he's going on and he's talking about his plan to save rural pubs. And basically his plan amounted to, sure, let people drive home drunk. It's fine. You know, it's like, you know, the pubs will still get the business. People get back home safe. You know, everybody's a winner. What could possibly go wrong? Okay. And so I saw this on and I was thinking, man alive, what is happening here? And so then I had my idea, right? So this is the theme of the week's news for me then. So it was, did that actually happen? Did I just see that? Did I just hear that? And so a couple of other things happened that week as well that were sort of fell into that kind of line. And so I did my, I recorded my column up in Manchester, and it went out, and it got a good response.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have, you know, I'm always on Twitter and stuff like that. And so somebody, you know, a woman called Kira, asked me tweeted me saying that was really good. I really enjoyed that. You know, politicians was sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I sort of followed her back and replied and said, oh, thanks very much. And the following day, then I get another. Tweet from her, and she goes, Paddy, I've been thinking more about this that column that you did yesterday, and I thought it was really good, but I publish books and I reckon there might be an idea in it. And I go and I look at this and I'm thinking, geez, is this some sort of, you know, phishing scam? You know, is this like a, you know, somebody, you know, like those emails you get?
Yes,
you know,
yeah,
I'm a prince and I have, you know,
which is she gonna ask me for? Yeah
and exactly. So I was thinking, this seems highly improbable, surely. But you know, I did a bit of looking into it, and this is, man, dear, it's an actual person. This is for real. And so it was one of those funny things, you know, because I had been, you know, I'd written sort of more or less off my own back and with not very much sort of money floating around it, but I was writing a lot of articles for a long time for different outlets and everything.
And when did when did all this start?
This is 2013. So this is February 2013. So like, by on St. Bridget's Day 2013, not a notion that a book was going to happen.
Okay.
By Valentine's Day, I'd signed up to do one. And the funny thing about it was is that it turned out that as soon as somebody, like, I had no, you know, imminent plans to write a book or anything. It was always something in the back of my head. You know, my grandfather was always saying, oh, you'll write a book one day and all that sort of stuff. But I never really paid much heed to it, you know. And but then it just completely came to me. And so as soon as she said, could you do a thing about Irish politics, a book about Irish politics, with a selection of stories that are in the vein of, you know, a man suggests, you know, the rural pub closures solution, but just letting people drive drunk. And I said, you know something, I've got a pile of them. Because I'd been a teacher of politics and I'd, you know, covered it for a long time. So I sort of had these sort of stored up in the back of my head because I quite like to go for the humorous angle in most things anyway.
Yeah.
And especially if you're teaching 15, 16-year-olds politics, you sort of need a bit of a, you know, a way in that's, you know.
So is that your background in teaching as well?
Yeah, well, I suppose sort of youth work specifically.
Yeah.
So I'd coming out of, there was a big kick in Donegal in around 2001, 2002 that it was sort of, you know, a sort of a self-determination thing really where young people were in the best position to discuss and to, you know, there were services that should be available to young people and young people should be at the coalface of deciding what those services should be and how should they be presented.
Do you not find a lot of young people now are they seemed to be getting more interested in politics. But at the time, apathy was sort of at the highest part of it.
Apathy was a big problem. I remember whenever I was in college in Galway, and it's like, you know, sometimes you'd be, I'd be covering the elections for the radio station, and you'd be lucky if one person was, you know, it'd be like North Korea or something, you know, there'd be barely an election happening at all. Yeah. And so there was that genuine worry. We sort of, you know, I remember we spent an awful lot of time debating, you know, what is exactly going wrong at the, like, are people so comfortable that they have no sort of sense of agitation, or are they just sort of drifting along? Mm. Obviously, you know, circumstances have changed dramatically in those sort of times, and so people certainly have their antennae up for a lot of political stories. But in terms of, I suppose it's all how you get into it, and it's how politics affects you, and even what you think politics is, you know, because the way I think of it anyway, everything is political to some degree or other. You know, from the morning you wake up, you know, and how much your breakfast costs, you know, what time you go to bed, because you have to work so hard, you know, to sort of pay your rent or whatever.
That's sort of adult thinking, but I'm sort of wondering, do the parents sort of shield the children? The kids sort of, they don't care where the money comes from. To the extent, I don't think about where it comes from. My breakfast is there, my dinner's there, my uniform's there. And if they don't have to think about where the money's coming from, the parents are shielding, I don't know if this is true or not, then they don't really have any need to get interested in politics. And then when they go to college, it's only when they have to start getting accommodation maybe, and stuff like that they start saying, oh, hold on, this is very expensive. Why is it so? And maybe talking to other students from around the world, their expansion, their relative mind,
this is one of the things that I always wanted to try to do, Noel, was to sort of increase the awareness at as young an age as possible. And, you know, you can't necessarily, you know, if people want to be shielded from something, people will find a way to shield themselves from it. But I've always tried to find it. So I think there's always a way to connect to people. There's always a way that people will respond to, you know, a political issue. So, for example, I used to do sort of workshops with the Donegal Youth Council back home, which was the first elected youth council. So every school became a ballot box, essentially. And so, you know, you had 12,000 students that were being elected by their peers. So it was a, you know, it was a sort of a game changing situation, really, in Donegal and in Ireland. Mm-hmm. Some people apply for their own reasons, and they get in for their own reasons, and, you know, the sort of the politics that they're interested in is not necessarily the sort of like the soap opera end at all. So it's a way of trying to connect all those dots. So I remember I used to do these things where it would be, you know, right, you're not just 15 people in the youth council now, you're the cabinet of a country. So they'd all have a ministry, and I'd give them all a piece of paper. And there was one guy, and he was very sort of disengaged, you know, and he said if he wasn't saying too much, and, you know, he wasn't being like a troublemaker or anything, but he was certainly a bit disengaged. But I knew he was big into cars and stuff. So I made him Minister for Transport. and we were chatting about, sort of bans on like tinted windows and, you know, sort of big exhausts and, you know, sort of like noise pollution and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, it's like, you know, sort of the situation was there was calls for a big clampdown and all this sort of stuff. Mm. All of a sudden, animated, and he was able to sort of rhyme off, not stats exactly, but you know what I mean? It's like he was able to sort of say, well, this is an issue of, you know, this is a rights issue. This is and so it's, you know,
he was able to exercise all of those things. Exactly, I was just thinking, we're going to be swamped with politics over the next 3 months.
But
I was just thinking when you were talking about Healy Ray there, did it actually happen?
Yeah.
I mean, and that sort of was the kickstart for your literary career to an extent. But I'm just thinking, I'm laughing to myself, that there must be a mighty tome over the past 2 years in Enda Kenny alone on some of the things he's been saying and the contradictions that, like, that's come out of some of his speeches.
This week alone has been pretty embarrassing on the world stage, you know. So he goes to Paris and he goes, nah, sorry, we can't do much about this whole, you know, global warming thing, you know, never mind, like, Cork might sink into the sea pretty soon, like, but you know, there's nothing we can do, lad, sorry about that, you know. So we're totally swamped over here. That was one of the things that I want to, obviously, in the last 2 years since it came out, so the last book came out November 2013. Mm-hmm. yeah, there's an awful lot has developed even in that time. You know, it's obviously sort of the, you know, the Irish water thing has really kicked off. There's been an awful lot of stuff with, say, like Alan Shatter and general sort of justice issues and everything else. That was one of the things that I wanted to do with the first book, actually, was because an awful lot of the sort of political books that were sort of in that general genre sort of, you know, circulated around Gubu and all that sort of stuff. I wanted to bring in, you know, a bit more up to date, you know, sort of from, you know, Rainbow Coalition onwards and stuff like that.
Yeah, incidentally, with the humour, a lot of it, it's quite universal, but it's, a lot of it is quite Irish orientated, so a lot of Irish people would just get it. In a cynical way, I often think, I mean, you're living in London now and you're sort of back and forward and back and forward, and I think the world and the country is changing very quickly. Do you think we're, as an Irish nation, we're still as that unique as we sort of think we are?
I think so. And that, well, that's one of the reasons that Do You Know Who's Dead sort of came about. That was sort of part of the stimulus, really, is because, you know, you'd be forgiven for thinking that, you know, living in London, you know, sort of my Irishness or what that even means to me might be diluted a bit. But far from it. If anything, it really sort of flushes it out. And people think of you as the Irish guy, and you know, you come out with phrases that people just don't understand, and you become very aware of what it is to be Irish. And so there's a lot of sort of factors at play, and it's sort of you can't but be self-conscious about it, actually. And not self-conscious in a bad way, but you certainly do realize, well, this is how we do things. You know, like, even, for example, one of the things that I found really peculiar is, of course, you know, if you're saying goodbye in Ireland, chances are you might just say, you know, good luck.
Yeah.
But, you know, unless you think, you know, I've said that to people in England and it's like, you know, they think that I've, like, cut their brakes or something, you know? They say good luck and then they say, well, what are you wishing me good luck for? What do you know? You know, it's like they get sort of awful paranoid about it.
Well, I always, I find as well that I'm, say, going through the airport or even on the street now or walking out of the building and someone would bump into me and I apologise. And I think that's unique Irish thing as well.
Absolutely, we're very, very apologetic. But I think, well, that's, you know, an interesting point, actually, because, you know, our Irish people, I think, do enjoy the love that we get across the world. You know, like, people go to, you know, Portugal, or they go, you know, sort of abroad for holidays anywhere, and they go, you know, are you English? And they go, no, I'm Irish. Oh, Irish, yes, you know, we love the Irish. So I think there's a bit of that, you know. So, but the flip side of that is that Irish people will always maybe present themselves on the back foot. So I think it's almost easier to say sorry when you're, but you know you're in the right.
Yes, yeah.
Easier to say sorry and sort of have everyone's good graces rather than say, oh, I mean, where you're going, and sort of people get a bit antsy. Yeah. I think it's a very pragmatic Irish way of sort of dealing with people.
And I think it makes people, that when you say you're sorry for it, oh, no, it was my fault.
It's a good, I think Irish people are very good at
getting people to drop their defences.
Charm and disarm.
Okay, just to go back on, you've been involved with a lot of TV. Tell me how you got involved with University Challenge, for instance, Top Gear, The Secret Fortune, Britain. I never heard of that. I'm well aware. And Ireland's Next Top Model. That was quite controversial there for a while.
But you've been
involved with TV. How did you get into TV?
So, well, when I got out of university, I had been doing a lot of the youth work that I've been chatting about, and I've been doing a fair bit of radio as well. And I've been mostly sort of talking head stuff. And I've been sort of chatting to people about doing different things in RTE and whatnot. And then sort of 2008 happened, you know, and sort of bank guarantees became sort of, you know, millstones around our neck. And then all of a sudden, a lot of the public sector stuff that I was doing, you know, with different county councils, working with young people, all that sort of stuff, just didn't really exist anymore. And radio, and certainly sort of in kind of national radio and stuff like that, is kind of, you sort of follow the crow a bit, you know.
Yes,
and it's like, you know, it's feast or famine anyway. And it turns out that it was a long enough famine in terms of, you know, sort of even the radio stuff and all that. So then I said, right, well, I'm going to change course. And so I went to I applied for, like, it was a young talent scheme at the Edinburgh Television Festival in 2008. And it genuinely changed my life in terms of the people that I met there, who, you know, a lot of them I'm still buddies with, in terms of sort of providing me with the sort of the confidence to do. I mean, it was just an absolutely seminal weekend. Mm-hmm. And so based from that, then I got chatting to a fellow at the BBC. And so he says, right, well, here's an application form for work experience. Now, I was 23, 4 at the time. Like, so I would have been a lot older than your average work experience person. But it's, you know, it's like, well, you know, this is not a time to have a pile of pride, you know. It's like, this is a good opportunity. So I went for it. And you're asked to write a paragraph about a BBC program. And so I wrote one about Top Gear because it's like everyone in my family watched it, you know, and it's like we all have very different tastes in the house back home.
Because you got that off your man you had in this, it's one of the students who you gave Minister for Transport.
Well, no, that would be a nice full circle story, wouldn't it? No. But based on that, so apparently the story goes, and I didn't find this out until much later, but I was supposed to be working in like entertainment development. So, you know, coming up with ideas for different, you know, game shows. Or different, you know, Saturday night takeaway sort of stuff. Yeah. But as it turns out, based on the paragraph that I wrote, it says, well, this guy seems to really like Top Gear, so let's put him on Top Gear. And so I worked on that for a while. I was sort of back and forth doing bits of, for instance, I don't know if you remember the film where they go with the Reliant Robin around Yorkshire.
Oh, yeah.
So I worked on that. And so there was a, you know, tribute video to Ayrton Senna, and I worked on that. And so there was, you know, different sort of things across. So I was sort of in and out with Top Gear for a while. And so that was great. And then, the Britain and Ireland's Next Top Model thing, I tend not to go into regrets, Noel. I tend to think, well, you know what, things happen for a reason. One of the things I truly regret was that I had signed up to do a day's running out in Kildare with Britain and Ireland's Next Top Model ages in advance. And then somebody from my old uni said, Garrett Fitzgerald is coming to do like a day in NUA Galway. Would you interview him? And I said, I'd love to. What's the date? And he tells me the date. And he says, oh, mother of God, I'm in Kildare. And I couldn't, you know, I said I had to sort of honour my thing. So that is my, like, sort of my eternal regret is that I didn't get to meet the good doctor and give him an interview.
Now, we're going to talk about the other book in a minute, but you've tipped into lots of spheres of entertainment and the media. Do you like the diversity of it, or is there anything now at your age or at now, still a very, very young man, that you said to yourself, now I really want to, this is what I want to try and focus on? Would you like to be in television all the time, or writing?
I have a very sort of short attention span exactly, but I do like to be doing a bunch of things at once. I think my concentration is such that I do need to be looking at a couple of different things at once, instead of I have some sort of multitasking. So it's like you know, like what you're saying about University Challenge, I've been doing quizzes for 20 years, and I don't know if one follows the other, but I have the sort of brain that takes little bit things at once. It's like, it's kind of like a mental buffet, you know. So I like to do a bunch of stuff at once. So like, I've been working in television now, I've been working on this documentary series about Obama, and it's behind the scenes work, and it's good work, but hard work. But it's a very different sort of style to say when I went home and then I would write the book. So even though, you know, I'd be sort of living on, you know, 4 hours sleep for a couple of months, it was a different kind. It was almost as restorative as sleep to go and write the book. So there's always going to be that balance between, you know, what'll pay your bills and what it is that you really like. And there's always going to be a bit of a tension between them. I'm a lot luckier than most, in fairness. Yeah. Now, I was saying that because I work in the industry that I want to work in, if not necessarily, you know, the exact one. I mean, I would love to be doing a bit more. I'd love to be doing a bit more radio sort of in front of mics or in with television instead of being a bit more sort of prominent like that. But I definitely do like to have the balance of doing different things.
Yeah, I think also if you find one medium, but it's not sustainable financially, you can find something else that can pay. You mightn't really love it, but it pays the bills, and then you can really concentrate on what you really enjoy. So if you get that balance,
well, that's the thing. Incidentally,
can I ask you something? I know I'm going off track here a bit. Can I ask you something? We talked there about observations, and you seem to be a very observation type of guy between back and forward. Yeah, and I'm a bit back and forward to London a bit myself, and I have noticed sometimes, and see what you think, that do you think sometimes the Irish can get conditioned? Like, I mean, when we're here, we're inclined to be integrate ourselves. I mean, we can sometimes get onto a bus and talk to a stranger. Mm. Now, the reason why I asked you, did you see many differences? Because I don't see that happening much the way it used to. Or I don't hear as much as how you when people are passing each other anymore. We seem to be just, you know, like that, you'd see on the screen flying along.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, are we getting more like that? Do you know what I mean? Conditioned, like, I mean, I imagine you'll always Paddy Duffy, but do you think that some of the younger people, when they go over, because of what they hear and the environment that they're in, they sort of quieting themselves a little bit? I'm a bit sort of extrovert here, I better sort of hold. Do you think that happens? Or would we?
That's an interesting one, though. I mean, I find that, well, I think you can go one or two ways with these sort of things. And I wouldn't necessarily consider myself, you know, the most here, the most, you know, flag-waving Irish man or anything like that, you know. But over there, you know.
I don't mean it in an Irish way, but just personality-wise.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, I think you either go more or you go a lot less. Okay. You know, there's a crossroads that you have to take a bit. And I think, yeah, there is a bit of conditioning, especially in London. There is a bit, you know, you sit in the tube in silence, and, you know, to talk to somebody is sort of a kind of heresy. You know, it's like there's some unbroken rule that you're that you're transgressing. You know, if people speak to me on the tube, I'll always speak to them. Mm-hmm. Invariably, though, the people who speak to them, you know, I've just come here from, you know, some other country, and it's like, how are you? And so there is a bit of that. I think there's. London is a very busy place. London's very, very busy, and it's like time and money are the big issues in London. You either have one or you have the other, but you never have both. And so I think an awful lot of people are always in a bit of a galloping rush, which is a bit of a shame, I suppose. And I don't know if you see it in Dublin as well.
Yeah, I do. That's why I mentioned it.
And that's the interesting. And I don't know what that is down to. I mean, maybe it's a case of, you know, obviously we've more global companies here now, say. So what's deemed as, like, say, professional sort of bleeds into all your sort of work, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've actually noticed it a bit in sort of areas that I work, you know. So I've come in and I would work in an office, say a small office, and, you know, you say hello individually to everybody, at least I would, and then you sort of get into this weird thing and you more or less almost sit down. You say, like, maybe some people say good morning, some people just sit down and there's no kind of interaction at all. And it's like the bigger it is, the more diffuse it gets, and it gets more difficult to get to know people in an office and stuff like that. So I think there's something about everybody, I think.
But even in a social sense, I mean, I'm just thinking now, technology has a big part to play in it. I was down to the doctor's this morning and just had it walking around, looking around, and there was, I think I counted 13 people. And normally when you get that many people in such close proximity, some sort of conversation, not with everyone now. I mean, not everyone wants to talk.
Yeah.
I was only heard something about a hairdresser's that they had in England, and I don't know whether they're adopting it here or not where. You walk in. I'm sort of jumping around here. But anyway, it's just an example that the older guy walks in and the hairdresser says, "Oh, what would you like?" And he says, "The silent chair." In other words, they had the chair designated in the hairdresser's where I don't want to talk to anyone, just do my hair, that's it. Anyway, in the doctor's, but I didn't notice with technology, as I say, out of the 13, there was 12 of them. There was one person because he had a kid, but the other 12 heads down on the phone.
Well, you see, the thing about that is, though, Noel, is that it can be kind of depressing. And I think somebody did like an art installation of, they took photos of people on their phones and they photoshopped out the phones.
Yeah.
So then it was just like people looking at their hands, and it was quite an impressive sort of thing. But the thing about it is that people have two lives now. People have two sort of identities. And I think this almost sort of comes back into the book, actually, because you've got your real life, your interactions, and then you've got your online life, your internet life.
Yes, yeah.
And there's as much socialising. Like, to not be on your phone is almost now more antisocial than not saying how you on the bus. You know, that is sort of the situation we're at. Yeah. The problem about that is that sort of it can unmoor you a bit from identity sometimes, which is why I think so many people make such an effort on, like, you know, there's so much nostalgia that floats around, especially with young people now. And, you know, sort of YouTube clips of stuff that they recognize when they were younger, because they need to sort of find some kind of sense to mirror themselves back in a sense of collective identity, where people are together and remember the same things, because you're sort of, you're floating away in space online, you know.
Okay, can we talk about Do You Know Who's Dead? We talked a bit about it on the, when you were on the phone before. This idea, tell me about this idea.
Well, I suppose it's originated from sort of two things that we've been talking about, you know, is that notion that you start to notice the really Irish things when you're, you know, with the perspective that being in a in another city brings. And then also that sort of sense of that collective identity and that need for a collective identity, especially at a time where, you know, so many people do live in this sort of big global hub, you know, where they're looking down at their hands.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of, it's a combination of both, really. And so I wanted to sort of examine some of the traits, some of the objects that we hold dear to Ireland, sort of through different things, through, you know, through mythology, through, you know, food and drink, through sport. And, you know, how we deal with all these things tells us a little bit about who we are.
It's amazing how we hang on to it. As you're speaking there, I'm just thinking, I remember way, way back when I was much, much younger and I was travelling here and there, and you'd hear, you see a place, Guinness, no, it's not the same as a home, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And people, and then you taste it, someone say, come on, and then you say, it's good, yeah. But now the new thing is, as you mentioned, food. Only recently, like, it was crisps and a few other little knickknacks, but now in London you can get potato.
But you don't.
No, it's the same.
We see, this is it. This is it. You see, and that's
the defense mechanism.
Well, this is it. It's kind of you wait a bit of time to get over there, but then it's like, you still need something to look forward to when you get home. These English potatoes, they're fine. that even speaks to, you know, sort of our, you know, I think in a weird way, I think everything, you know, whether it be food or drink or whatever else, it does sort of tell you a bit about the system from which it comes. So, for instance, you know, there's two varieties of potato in Ireland. There's one that's made out in Ashburn, and then there's one in Tandragee in Armagh. So there's northern potato and southern potato. Oh, yeah.
But they're not the same either.
That's and what we're told. Even the Mr. Potato looks a bit different in Northern Ireland and stuff like that, you know?
Different colours, isn't it?
Different. Oh, yeah. Sort of, it's a bit more orangey, actually, come to think of it. God, I didn't even spot that before. But there's stuff like, or it's like, I always find that, you know, biscuits even, you know, it's like, what sort of sums up Ireland more? I can't think of anything that sums up Ireland more than the notion of saying, I'm giving up chocolate for Lent, but a yellow snack is okay because it's technically a biscuit. The amount of people I hear sort of say, oh, can I have a chocolate digestive? You know, it's like, it's only half chocolate. It's only like a thin layer of chocolate. That doesn't count. I mean, like bars, you know? And that's, I think that's it's a very Irish way to deal with the world. It's like, I'm going to set myself this task, but I'm going to allow myself a wee bit of wiggle room here just in case I need it.
Okay, listen, I don't know. I just looked up at the clock. I didn't realize we'd be talking for half an hour. I didn't even have a break.
It's like Desert Island Disc, isn't
it? Up. Yeah, so next time you're in Dublin, do make it a point to come in. Just give us details of anything you have going on there with the books now. I'm sure they can get the Did That Really Happen is still available, and also Do You Know Who's Dead is there as well.
Yeah. Do You Know Who's Dead is available in sort of all good bookshops, sort of independent chain otherwise, and you can also get it on Amazon as well. So if you type in my name, Paddy Duffy, or Do You Know Who's Dead into Amazon, and then you'll be able to find me, and then you'll also be able to find Did That Actually Happen as well, if you fancy going for a too far. So of course, if, with Amazon as well, if you have people in the diaspora who are noticing that they've become a little bit more Irish since they've gone to Bondi Beach or Vancouver or whatever, maybe this is a book for them as well.
Okay, well, thank you very much for the moment, Paddy. I hope to get you in again. Thank you
very much.
And we go to a break.